Hello, everyone, and welcome to Classic Gaming Today, where we take a look at the gaming experiences of the past through the eyes of the present. I am your host, Tony, and today we're going to look at Dynamite Cop, a three-dimensional beat-em-up title developed and published by Sega and released to arcades in 1998 with a port to the Sega Dreamcast system following in 1999. We're going to talk about that title in just a couple minutes, but first, as is usual, just a little bit of housekeeping up front. This is episode number 84, and it is not just any episode. This is another Patreon-sponsored episode. This one is being sponsored by Dave Morton, who said, hey, you need to play Dynamite Cop. So, as contractually obligated as I am, I did, in fact, play Dynamite Cop, and we're going to be talking about that in just a little bit. But first, as we always do with our Patreon-sponsored episodes, I want to give our sponsor an opportunity to tell us why Dynamite Cop is such a big deal. So, Dave, take it away.
Alrighty, Dynamite Cop. What can we say about Dynamite Cop? Well, let's start by saying that I am 40, I am a nerd, and by using simple A plus B equals C logic, I have impeccable taste. Except for Jersey Shore, which I have an excuse for that. They film in my hometown. They use a lot of interstitial shots from the streets of my hometown. They got into a fight at a restaurant around me one time. That restaurant is within walking distance of me. So, you know, it's more like local civic pride. Anyway, Dynamite Cop. At first blush, Dynamite Cop seems like a bit of an ink spot on my resume. Because let's go through the reasons here. Number one, it seems short. Number two, it comes from what is considered, I think maybe unfairly, a shallow genre, the beat-em-up. It has quick time events, so if you're running a bingo card of bad decisions in video games, this is a great candidate for you. But with all that said, though, it's got a lot to offer. First and foremost, upon turning it on, you will notice that it is deeply blue sky, which of course was Sega's catch-all term for the various games it made during that era, with its bright blue skies, bright colors, over-the-top characters, and general sense of style. As you would expect with an over-the-top beat-em-up, multiplayer is fantastic, supporting up to four players. And as we all know, four players is better than two. And most of all, it has a sense of humor, which, of course, in this genre is just super, super important. By this point, the beat-em-up genre is getting older. It has seen its fair share of licenses and gameplay enhancements. But one thing I think that maybe hadn't fully been realized was the ways of making fun of it, ways of poking back at the tropes and the characters and the general style of game that a beat-em-up is, and this game does that. After all, there are fish and rocket launchers and everything in between for you to pummel your enemies with. Characters overact and make it feel over the top. Think of Metal Wolf Chaos, a game I'm sure all of you can pull from memory right off the top of your head. However, with all these great things, this isn't why the game sticks in my head. Instead, this game is a lesson on the powers of marketing and how they can work on a young brain. You'll see, I had a subscription to the official Dreamcast magazine, the one that came with the demo disc. And in issue number two, the demo disc included Dynamite Cop, among a couple of others. But Dynamite Cop was really the star of the show, and I played the heck out of it. I played the opening level that it provided over and over and over and over again, maybe in possibly 20 to 30 minute chunks. So I did what any logical kid would do. I pre-ordered it. And back in this era, of course, you didn't just go onto a website and press a button. You had to walk uphill in snow 10 miles each way to go to your local EB Games, or in my case, Stop and Shop Games, and pre-order it. It wasn't just something you kind of did offhandedly or canceled easily or anything like that. You had to plan this out. So the day came. I went to school. I came home from school. I went and got the game. I played it once, and I returned it. Because, of course, you could do that back in this era. In the end, the game was just too thin, and I had to import my friends from other houses to play multiplayer, being an only child. And in this era, games had to hit. We were not yet at the period of all the games, so when you made a purchasing decision, it had to last you at least a little bit or give itself some sort of justification for existing in your collection, which at the time, unfortunately, this just did not do. However, it is 2024, and in the end, I actually think that Dynamite Cop is a little bit of a forgotten Dreamcast gem. It has the same style and look and feel as many of the other Sega games of the era. Again, that blue sky era of the Sonic Adventures, Jet Set Radio, Crazy Taxi, the fishing games, on and on and on. You name it, it's a Sega blue sky. The easy thing to do is knock it, but smack someone with a fish along with three friends, and it will find its way to the top of your beat-em-up list, especially on Dreamcast. Anyway, I just want to say thank you, Tony. Thank you, CGT community. Y'all rule. I am the Dizzle. but you can call me Dave.
Thank you, Dave, once again for your message, your sponsorship, and your support. If you would like to sponsor an episode or just get in touch with me to talk about classic games, technology, or whatever, there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle at ClassicGamingT. I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. We do weekly and monthly gaming challenges. We have prizes, rewards. It's just a great time. I really encourage you to check out our Discord. I also encourage you to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including a Patreon-exclusive bi-weekly podcast expansion pack, patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday is where it's at. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our Pantheon patrons. They are ISO, Rich Senewald, David Morton, Sam Twardowski, Sean Marshall, Steve Novoselic, and Wendell Jr. Thank you guys for supporting the show. Thank you all for supporting the show, whether you contribute monetarily or simply listen on a regular basis. I truly do appreciate all of the support. For anyone who may be new, welcome. I'd like to give a brief overview of the anatomy of an episode because, for the most part, all of our episodes follow a very similar format and structure. We will always start by talking about the history of the game in question, the historical context. How was the game made? Why was the game made? And then we move into a pseudo-review kind of section. And I say pseudo-review because it's not like we assign a numerical ranking or star count or anything like that. But we do talk about every single game from several different perspectives. We take a look at the graphics. How does the game look? The sound and music. How does the game sound? The narrative and or story, if the game has one. Playability and controls and overall feel. What does it feel like to play the game today versus when it was released 20, 30, maybe even 40 plus years ago? We do all of that to reach a verdict as far as how well the game holds up today. And to do that, we assign each game to one of several categories. At the very top of our list is the Pantheon of Classic Gaming. If a game reaches the Pantheon, you know it is that darn good. It is a certifiable classic. You should go out of your way to play those games today. Just beyond the Pantheon are our golden oldies. These are still really good games. I still highly encourage you to play them, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game exists. By all means, you should have a good time. They're not quite Pantheon level, but they are still really good experiences, and I still highly encourage you to play them today. Beyond the golden oldies, we reach our mediocre mentions. This is where we start getting into the realm of games that I cannot recommend to the broad population. They might have aged a little bit, might have had a couple of issues to begin with. You may still have a good time, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game lives. By all means, give it a go. But I cannot recommend these games to the broad gaming population. And then beyond the mediocre mentions, we reach the footnotes. These are the games that are best left in the annals of history. I have played them, so you don't have to. I cannot recommend anyone play these titles today. They have either aged incredibly poorly, or they may not have been all that great to begin with. With that out of the way, we're going to start talking about the game of the day. That is Dynamite Cop. Dynamite Cop is a three-dimensional beat-em-up title developed and published by Sega and released to arcades back in 1998 with a port to the Dreamcast console following in 1999. Before we can talk about Dynamite Cop, we've got to take a step back to take a look at the beat-em-up genre in general around the mid-90s. Longtime listeners may recall that we've talked about the evolution of the beat-em-up genre several times in past episodes, from the very earliest examples like Takashi Nishiyama's Kung Fu Master from 1984, through to Double Dragon in 1987, which really popularized the concept of urban combat as opposed to kung fu duels, to 1989's Final Fight, which has one of my personal favorite characters, Mike Hagar. All the way to 1992's Streets of Rage 2, which many people, myself included, consider to be one of the best beat-em-up titles of all time. Across the history of the genre, the mechanics, gameplay, and overall structure of each game would shift, with each successive title adding new controls, more complex encounters, and broader rosters of characters. And I would argue that from the late 80s through the early to mid-90s, beat-em-ups would experience their golden age, so to speak, where games in the genre were pervasive across nearly all platforms, from arcades to home consoles. I speak from personal experience when I say some of the most fun you could have in an arcade in the early 90s was grabbing a fistful of quarters, finding the nearest multiplayer beat-em-up title, nestling in next to another player, and simply enjoying the button-mashing carnage that would ensue. Right around the same time beat-em-ups were becoming more mainstream, another genre of gaming was also becoming insanely popular, that being the competitive fighting game. And interestingly, some of the first tournament-driven fighting titles were inspired by and evolved from some of those early beat-em-up titles we were just talking about. Perhaps the most important release in the early tournament fighting genre was the very first Street Fighter, which was designed by the same person who designed Kung Fu Master, Takashi Nishiyama. He envisioned an evolution to the side-scrolling beat-em-up formula, where rather than having to make your way through a level and battle minions before you could tackle the stage's boss, you could instead have a series of boss-level kinds of encounters, effectively making the entire game a bunch of boss fights. This concept, which was not necessarily new, would really gain traction with the release of Street Fighter II in 1991, and the introduction of rival fighting game Mortal Kombat in 1992. And with those releases, fighting games would themselves enter a period of rapid mainstream growth, with countless clones of both Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat flooding arcades and home consoles. While both beat-em-ups and tournament-style fighting games have the same heritage and are somewhat similar to one another, as they were both growing up at the same time, so to speak, they did have some pretty well-defined differences. In general, beat-em-ups were the simpler of the two, with character movesets that might consist of a series of punches, kicks, and grapples, and gameplay strategies typically revolving around needing to get close to an enemy and pound on your attack buttons quicker than enemies attack you. A lot of times, beat-em-up difficulty was derived based on how many enemies a given game would throw at you, and what kinds of weapons those enemies would be carrying. Tournament fighters, by contrast, had significantly deeper controls and fighting mechanics, where many times players would have the ability to choose between a number of different punches and kicks, each with dedicated buttons on your arcade control deck or console controller, as well as the ability to string different punches, kicks, and joystick direction presses into combos and special moves, a feature that was missing from many beat-em-up titles. While tournament fighters could be played in a similar style to beat-em-ups, that being mash your buttons and hope to win, this was a surefire recipe for defeat, both at the hands of arbitrarily difficult computer-controlled characters, as well as skilled human combatants who recognized opportunities to punish less skilled players and their frantic button presses. Eventually, game developers would begin to merge the two styles of gameplay, taking the overall structure of the beat-em-up genre with its stage-based environments with numerous enemies to dispatch, and marrying it with the increased depth of tournament fighter gameplay, where rather than simply mashing buttons, you'd have a set of combos and maneuvers available to you, where depending on your button inputs and which character you had selected, you could execute a number of different moves. And it was this combination of gameplay styles that formed the foundation of the revolutionary beat-em-up title Streets of Rage 2 in 1992. With Streets of Rage 2, brother-sister duo Yuzo and Ayano Kashiro came up with a fighting system that was heavily inspired by the then-popular arcade title Street Fighter 2, with full-scale combos, special moves, and situation-based attacks that would change depending on which character you selected and what specific button inputs you were using. And gamers everywhere loved the increased depth that, for the first time, was featured in a side-scrolling beat-em-up title. This evolution of the genre is why, for many, Streets of Rage 2 represents the pinnacle of the beat-em-up's golden age. And while future titles in both the Streets of Rage series, as well as other games, would mimic the Streets of Rage 2 formula, none would really be as widely regarded as that original title. With the popularity of both beat-em-ups and tournament fighters, you'd likely guess that there would be a ton of different releases over the years, and here you would be absolutely right, as both genres would be represented by several outstanding releases, like the titles we've talked about, as well as a significant number of half-hearted attempts to gain a foothold in an ever-increasing popular market. As we've seen time and time again, as something becomes heavily imitated, average quality generally suffers, and consumer confidence often falters, which is one of the reasons why, as the mid-90s rolled around, there wasn't nearly as much attention being paid to both beat-em-ups and traditional two-dimensional tournament fighters, at least outside of a few key game series. Another reason why consumer attention was diverted elsewhere was due to a general shift that was impacting the entire video and computer game industry, a change that would end up revolutionizing gaming technology and, in the process, would set the stage for nearly every modern video game that we all know and love today. That new revolutionary technology was none other than three-dimensional graphics. Generally speaking, the consoles, arcade titles, and computer games of the 80s through the early 90s were dominated by two-dimensional sprite-based pixel graphics, primarily because that was the technology available to game designers of the time, and that technology was really good at processing 2D sprite-based visuals. As the 90s progressed, though, technological advances in gaming hardware drove the introduction of true three-dimensional visuals into games using polygons as opposed to sprites, and texture mapping as opposed to pixel art. Now, utilizing true three-dimensional graphics in a game wasn't technically a new thing, as we can see examples of 3D in gaming throughout video and computer game history, such as in the flight simulator space, as well as some more experimental 3D-based titles that utilized flat-shaded three-dimensional objects to make up game worlds. But those early 3D efforts were, generally speaking, slow-paced and not all that detailed, as game designers were effectively using clever coding tricks and graphics processing algorithms to force hardware to do something it was never designed to do. And in the process, performance would end up suffering. Processing pixel art and sprites was something hardware of the time was good at. Processing 3D visuals was another thing entirely. But as technology continued to advance, utilizing 3D graphics in games became much more achievable, and it wouldn't take long before 3D visuals were pervasive across the industry, with some home consoles, like the Nintendo 64, designed from the ground up as a 3D graphics powerhouse, while computer gamers began experiencing the wonder of 3D accelerated titles driven by companies like 3DFX, S3, and Matrox. And arcades, as has been the case for the majority of the video game industry's lifetime, remained the spot for the highest quality, most cutting-edge 3D gameplay and graphics out there. As these 3D graphics began invading every corner of the video game industry, a number of genres would begin transitioning from their two-dimensional roots into fully realized three-dimensional entries. And one type of game in particular that really pushed for rapid adoption of 3D into its gameplay was the fighting game genre. Tournament fighters like Street Fighter II, Mortal Kombat, and others had, up to this point, been restricted to both two-dimensional character designs as well as two-dimensional stages. You could move and attack to the left and to the right, but that was pretty much it. Now, with the introduction of 3D technology into video games, fighting games could take on an entirely new dimension, literally. Rather than being restricted to a two-dimensional plane, games would now have the ability to feature stages that players could walk into, creating situations where gamers could circle their opponent in the hopes of getting in an unexpected attack from either the side or their back. Character models, similarly, could now be defined with actual depth, making moves feel even more impactful and giving a sense of weight to the experience that had, up to this point, been lacking. And, as was the case with 2D tournament fighting games, the world of 3D tournament fighters would rapidly expand, with games like Virtua Fighter, Tekken, Soul Edge, and Battle Arena Toshinden popularizing the genre, and making it so that nearly any arcade you'd go to would be filled, wall to wall, with 3D fighting games for players to test their skills on. While tournament fighting games would quickly adopt 3D technology into their gameplay, its sister genre, side-scrolling beat-em-ups, would not follow suit quite as quickly, primarily because it wasn't entirely clear how the use of true 3D in a beat-em-up title would be appreciably better than traditional 2D gameplay. Most beat-em-up titles in the 90s already included depth in their game worlds, with players able to navigate into and out of various scenes while they attacked enemies. Sure, each character could only really face straight ahead or backwards, meaning that even though scenes had depth, gameplay was still decidedly fixed in a two-dimensional plane. And for the most part, people were happy with that gameplay, though visually, pixel art-driven beat-em-up titles began to fall out of favor as 3D fighting games began to capture the attention of gamers around the world. At the same time 3D was running wild in arcades, home console makers began to include 3D gameplay in their titles and hardware, with the latest generation of consoles in the mid-90s competing with each other to deliver the best, most visually impressive gameplay experiences to consumers. At the time, there were three main players in the home console space. Nintendo, who was readying the release of their Nintendo 64 console, Sony, who had recently released their PlayStation console, and Sega, who, after creating a literal tower of power built on top of the 16-bit Sega Genesis, was ready to release their own next-generation console, the Sega Saturn. Now, before we continue, we need to take a step back and talk about Sega specifically, a company with a long history in the video game industry, and, perhaps most notably, one of the few companies who focused on both arcade hardware as well as home console technology. And this dual focus led the company to create a variety of games and hardware that would attempt to bridge the gap between the arcade and living room gaming experience. As we talked about, from the 1970s through the mid-90s, arcades were the spot to find the most advanced, high-tech games available. And while there would be numerous ports of arcade titles to home consoles, typically, those ports would be limited in terms of graphics, sound, or features in comparison to their arcade counterparts. Sega, with the release of their Genesis console, attempted to push the envelope in terms of recreating an arcade-like experience at home, even going so far as to release the console using Altered Beast as the pack-in title included with the system, with marketing focused on the concept that now, high-quality arcade games were finally able to be played at home. In reality, the Genesis was not capable of 100% arcade-perfect ports, but Sega did in fact get pretty darn close, and as they continued to develop the hardware for both home and arcades, they started to create different tiers of technology across their company. Sega's top-tier arcade technology of the early to mid-90s, the Model 2 arcade board, would end up powering their most intense gaming experiences with the most advanced visuals, like Daytona USA and Virtua Fighter 2. And while those titles would be insanely popular, they would also be incredibly expensive, and would be difficult to port to home consoles because of the advanced technology that was being utilized. Sega recognized that there was also a market for more modest gaming experiences, and in addition to the top-tier Model 2 board, they would also create a less powerful variant known as the Sega Titan Video Arcade System, or STV. This version of Sega's hardware would be more modest in comparison, and would in fact be based on the hardware that formed the foundation of the Sega Saturn home console, which created a couple of different opportunities for the company. For one, the STV was much lower cost than the Model 2 board, which meant there was greater potential for shipping and selling more arcade units, since the cost to arcade operators would be much lower than Model 2-based games. And secondarily, because the technology behind the STV was very similar, if not identical in some instances, to the hardware powering the Sega Saturn home console, porting these games to the system would be much simpler to accomplish, and would get closer than ever to delivering a true arcade-quality experience in the comfort of gamers' living rooms. As you might expect, Sega was excited about this lower-cost opportunity, so they chose to manufacture a huge number of STV arcade boards in the hopes of selling a ton of arcade cabinets based on that technology. And sure, while Sega STV-based games would sell moderately well, the number of arcade boards in inventory dwarfed the number of arcade cabinets Sega was selling. Sega needed some new games to take advantage of their low-cost arcade technology. Right around the time the STV arcade board was introduced into the arcade market, Sega was able to acquire a fairly popular film license for use in future video game titles. That being the classic Christmas movie that also happened to have some quality action scenes, Die Hard. The first Die Hard film was released in 1988 and starred Bruce Willis as an off-duty New York City police detective named John McClane, who inadvertently becomes trapped in a Los Angeles office skyscraper that had been taken over by a group of armed terrorists, capturing an office full of hostages in the process. Luckily for the hostages, and unluckily for the terrorists, John McClane couldn't possibly take this situation lying down, and over the course of the film, he would almost single-handedly defeat the entire terrorist cell, saving his estranged wife and her office mates in the process, while at the same time giving moviegoers one of the most intense and entertaining action films of the 80s, which, considering the number of action films released in that decade, is certainly something worthy of attention. As with many successful action films, a number of sequels would follow, with Die Hard 2 releasing in 1990, and Die Hard with a Vengeance, the third film in the series, releasing in theaters in 1995. With the release of the third film and its popularity at the box office, the time was right for Sega, the current video game license holder for the property, to actually do something with the license. So, they contacted their American-based subsidiary, the Sega Technical Institute, to begin conceptualizing a new game using the Die Hard license. With that direction in place, the Sega Technical Institute and Sega's AM1 Arcade Development Division began collaborating to create a new Die Hard arcade game, one that would capture the over-the-top action of the original film, while at the same time leveraging the surplus Sega Titan Video arcade board inventory that Sega had been sitting on. The team wanted to replicate the feeling of battling a ton of bad guys while traversing a series of different environments, similar to how John McClane himself battled through Nakatomi Plaza, dispatching terrorists left and right as he made his way through the building. It didn't take long before the team realized this would make a perfect beat-em-up title, which is what led to the creation of Die Hard Arcade in 1996. Unlike other beat-em-up titles of the time, Die Hard Arcade would be designed to be a truly three-dimensional action experience, leveraging polygon-based characters and environments with full texture mapping for the very first time in the beat-em-up genre. Prior to Die Hard Arcade, beat-em-ups were still leveraging sprite-based visuals. With Die Hard Arcade, the beat-em-up genre was now the newest member of the 3D technology club. The development team, similar to how Yuzo and Ayano Kishiro were inspired by Street Fighter II's fighting system when creating Streets of Rage 2, were all impressed with the fighting gameplay of games like Sega's own Virtua Fighter 2, and they were determined to make Die Hard Arcade a deeper experience than other beat-em-up titles of the time. Rather than simply having players be able to punch, kick, and jump their way through the game, the team behind Die Hard Arcade would implement a fighting system that was, effectively, inherited from Virtua Fighter 2, complete with grapple maneuvers, various multi-punch and kick combinations, and a series of combo moves that would add significant depth to the gameplay. Unlike Virtua Fighter 2, Die Hard Arcade would also include a ridiculous number of weapons that could be picked up and used while fighting through the game's various stages, and would, perhaps most innovatively, include several tag team maneuvers that could only be executed when playing with a friend, something that had very rarely been included in beat-em-up games released up to that point. As the game neared its release date, the team began considering how best to handle an international launch, and here they hit a bit of a snag. The Die Hard license that Sega had acquired only covered video games released in the United States, which meant that releasing Die Hard Arcade in Japan would be a bit of an issue. Instead, the team would have to revise the game to remove all references to Die Hard, with John McClane becoming newly created Super Cop Bruno Dellinger, and Die Hard Arcade becoming renamed as Dynamite Deca, which translates to Dynamite Detective in English. Die Hard Arcade, or Dynamite Deca, depending on where you live, was released to a fair degree of acclaim in both the arcades as well as Sega's Saturn home console, where it would be named one of the best Sega Saturn games of all time, and would, in the arcade space, become Sega's highest-selling US-produced arcade game ever made. As it relates to the quality of the Saturn port, recall that the arcade technology the Die Hard Arcade was built on, the Sega Titan video system, is the same technology powering the Sega Saturn. What this meant is that when it came time to port Die Hard Arcade to the Saturn, the process was relatively straightforward, and that port more so than many other titles of the time, would represent a true arcade-perfect conversion of the original title. And even beyond arcade perfection, Sega would include a number of add-on features when Die Hard Arcade released on the Saturn, such as the inclusion of the classic 1979 Sega arcade title Deep Scan, which players could play to earn extra credits for use in Die Hard Arcade's main campaign. Die Hard Arcade for the time represented the most technologically advanced beat-em-up title on the market, and it wouldn't take long before Sega would begin considering the creation of a sequel to the title. A couple of issues, though, would impact that game's creation. For one, the Sega Technical Institute ended up shuttering its doors after the release of Die Hard Arcade, which meant that the American leg of Sega's game development division was effectively gone. And secondly, Sega had lost the Die Hard license, meaning they could no longer create games using any sort of Die Hard references or nomenclature. While those two issues might sound like potential showstoppers, Sega also had a couple of opportunities. Die Hard Arcade was only really known as Die Hard Arcade in the United States, so luckily for Sega, they already had internal intellectual property, so to speak, that they could leverage for the sequel, that being the Japanese exclusive Dynamite Deca title. And Sega's AM1 arcade division had collaborated closely with the Sega Technical Institute while creating Die Hard Arcade, so it's not like they didn't have any developers familiar with the title. And finally, Sega was also readying for the release of their next-generation video game console, the Sega Dreamcast, which was incredibly more powerful than the Sega Saturn, and could, without issue, play games designed for Sega's more powerful arcade technology, like the Model 2 arcade board. Meaning, even more so than with the Sega Saturn, Sega could bring their highest quality arcade experiences into the home, giving console gamers everywhere even more engaging, graphically rich gaming experiences. That combination of opportunities, along with the success of the original Die Hard arcade title, prompted Sega to instruct its AM1 arcade division to begin working on a sequel to Die Hard Arcade, which in Japan would follow on directly from the first title and be named Dynamite Deku 2. When the time came to release the title in the United States, a more dramatic renaming would be required. Instead of Die Hard Arcade 2, the new sequel would be released as Dynamite Cop. Similar to Die Hard Arcade, Dynamite Cop would utilize three-dimensional graphics and visuals to power the game, as well as a combo-based fighting system, albeit with a number of enhancements like more advanced controls, broader freedom of movement, and more over-the-top gameplay, which is saying something considering that Die Hard Arcade was itself a pretty over-the-top title to begin with. Also similarly to Die Hard Arcade, Dynamite Cop would be enhanced when ported to the Sega Dreamcast system, as it would feature not only identical arcade-quality graphics and gameplay, but would also include the 1980 Sega arcade title Tranquilizer Gun, as well as a number of collectibles and unlockable scenarios that would be exclusive to the Dreamcast version of the title, serving to enhance an already stellar arcade port. Dynamite Cop would end up releasing to arcades in June of 1998, with the aforementioned Dreamcast port following a year later in 1999, though interestingly, the build-up to the game's original release was a bit more unique than most titles. Generally speaking, when games were unveiled to the public around this time frame, they'd either make their debut at an industry event like the Electronics Entertainment Expo, or E3, or one of the various arcade-centric events held across the globe. With Dynamite Cop, the development team, and in particular the game's director, Makoto Uchida, would do something decidedly different. Dynamite Cop itself takes place primarily on a cruise ship, effectively speed-toing Die Hard's original skyscraper game world. Well, rather than unveil the game at a trade show, Uchida and the team unveiled the game on an actual cruise ship, complete with Uchida cosplaying as Bruno Dellinger, and some unlucky AM1 developer being forced, on the spot, into cosplaying as the president's daughter, much to his chagrin. Putting aside the interesting marketing tactics that preceded the game's release, upon its release, critics would have mixed opinions, with some praising the game's continued evolution of the beat-em-up genre and its inclusion of insane, over-the-top gameplay scenarios, while others would criticize the game's relatively short playtime and, in their words, last-generation graphics. Now, I should note that Dynamite Cop was in fact based on Sega's Model 2 arcade board, which at the time of its release had been superseded by both the Model 3 and Naomi arcade boards, the latter of which was effectively the same hardware architecture as the Dreamcast, albeit with more available memory. So from that perspective, the graphics were, in fact, last generation, and interestingly, wouldn't push the Dreamcast hardware, as that console itself was based on a more modern architecture. Regardless, Dynamite Cop would garner a number of fans over the years, and would also build a bit of a legacy, as some characters, like John McClane's stand-in Bruno Dellinger, would make cameos in other Sega titles, like zombie shooter House of the Dead 2. And Dynamite Deku 2, at least in Japan, would receive an arcade-only Japanese-exclusive sequel in 2007, entitled Asian Dynamite, which was based on the Naomi architecture and featured much more advanced technological capabilities than either of the two prior titles in the series. I haven't personally played that one, and I admittedly didn't even realize that the game existed before beginning research for this podcast episode, but now that I know it exists, I definitely want to give it a go. Despite its inconsistent critical response, Dynamite Cop represents an interesting release in gaming history. As the continued evolution of a genre that got its start back in the 80s, there is a lot to appreciate about Dynamite Cop's 3D visuals, deep combat system, and advanced, for the time, arcade gameplay. While many beat-em-up titles today are focused on recapturing the nostalgia of late 80s and early 90s titles, like Streets of Rage 4 and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Shredder's Revenge, I do believe there's a place for more advanced titles that could potentially evolve the genre as a whole, which is exactly what Dynamite Cop did back in 1998. It may not be as fondly reminisced about as many of the games from the golden era of beat-em-ups, like Final Fight, but that in no way diminishes the quality of the title, and I would venture a guess that for fans of the game, Dynamite Cop will likely remain an experience that will undoubtedly be remembered forever. We are now going to shift to start talking about what it feels like to play Dynamite Cop today versus when it was released just around 25 years ago. At its core, Dynamite Cop is a three-dimensional interpretation of the traditional side-scrolling beat-em-up formula, and in many ways, it truly does represent an evolution to the gameplay seen in such games as Final Fight, Streets of Rage 2, The Punisher, and countless other titles. Typical to most beat-em-up titles, you control one of several characters, and your goal is to make your way through a series of stages with a number of different enemies, obstacles, and environments, occasionally encountering boss fights while continually progressing through the story until you ultimately face off against the big bad guy at the end of the game. While that structure is fairly typical in the beat-em-up genre, there are a number of ways that Dynamite Cop tweaks that foundation to create something that is more unique. Before we begin, though, I should mention that my impressions of the game are based exclusively on the single-player content included with the title. There is cooperative multiplayer included as well, and I would imagine that as with most beat-em-up titles, multiplayer co-op is likely insanely fun, and decidedly more fun than the pure single-player experience. I can't confirm that myself, but given how much fun I had being a solo player, I can only imagine how much fun fighting alongside a buddy would be. Anyway, let's start talking more specifically about Dynamite Cop. What you'll likely notice fairly early on, and probably the most visibly apparent difference between Dynamite Cop and other similar beat-em-ups, is the fact that Dynamite Cop is a fully three-dimensional affair, meaning its environments, objects, and characters are all based on real 3D models, rather than pseudo-representations of three-dimensional spaces as you might see in other beat-em-ups. To put this into perspective, it is not uncommon for side-scrolling beat-em-ups to allow you to walk into or out of a scene, meaning you do have a sense of depth to each screen you're walking through. So the fact that you have a three-dimensional environment here at face value might not seem like a big deal. The difference, though, is that in those pseudo 3D representations of depth, everything is still decidedly programmed and designed in two dimensions, and this is most apparent as you observe the movement of your characters. If you're playing one of these traditional games and you go to move into the scene, you'll notice that your character remains facing either left or right. You will never see your character turn and actually walk deeper into the scene. And similarly, enemy characters will always only be oriented in a side-to-side facing direction. What this means is that any time you attack an enemy, or any time you are attacked, you will always be treated as though those moves can only take place in two dimensions. In Dynamite Cop, by contrast, everything is modeled using a true three-dimensional space, which means moves, movement, and attacks can come from every direction and from every orientation. This might sound like a small thing, but it opens up entirely new gameplay possibilities that just weren't possible before. And from my perspective, in order to truly create a proper 3D beat-em-up, you really do need everything to be 3D. And to explain why that is, we need to talk about Dynamite Cop's predecessor, Die Hard Arcade. Die Hard Arcade, like Dynamite Cop, utilizes three-dimensional characters, models, and environments to deliver its beat-em-up gameplay. But even within those three dimensions, moves can only occur on a two-dimensional plane, meaning side to side. Playing through Die Hard Arcade, I experienced a strange cognitive dissonance related to everything being 3D around me, but not actually being able to experience full 3D movement. And honestly, it didn't feel all that great. Luckily, Dynamite Cop avoided that issue by making a fully 3D experience, and it is all the better for it. Now, within those 3D environments, you will face a variety of enemies to defeat, and the game provides you with multiple tools in order to dispatch your foes, with perhaps the most important feature being the game's fighting system. Longtime listeners may recall our discussion on Streets of Rage 2 from last year, where I heaped a ton of praise on that game's fighting system. Like we talked about a little bit ago, most beat-em-ups have very simple fighting systems, where you can punch, kick, jump, grapple, and use some form of special maneuver, but that's pretty much it. Streets of Rage 2 evolved beyond that formula by adding in a combo system, with specific special combos and moves for each of the game's characters, which made the game feel much deeper than the traditional beat-em-up experience. Imagine a fighting system similar to Street Fighter 2, but with the expansive levels of an arcade beat-em-up, and you pretty much have Streets of Rage 2. Well, Dynamite Cop accomplishes the same exact feat, albeit in 3D. The game gives you access to three characters to choose from, each of whom have their own moveset, combos, special maneuvers, strengths, and weaknesses. And each character's moveset is inspired, at least in part, by popular 3D fighting games of the time, like Virtua Fighter 3, in a similar kind of situation as how Street Fighter 2 formed the inspiration for Streets of Rage 2. And for the most part, this deeper fighting system works very well within the context of the game. It takes what might have otherwise been a fairly straightforward, very arcade-centric fighting experience and adds significantly more depth to the overall experience, which does wonders for the game's replayability, as there's a lot to master here. It's not simply a button-mashing affair, though admittedly, you can play it as a button masher too and still be somewhat successful. Beyond the purity of the fighting system, the game also includes a number of usable objects and destructible environments throughout the title, and the degree to which objects and environments are usable is actually pretty insane. If you see an object on the screen, you can pretty much count on it being destructible, or able to be picked up and swung, or thrown at an enemy. The amount of usable weapons and environmental objects runs the gamut from traditional fare like guns, spears, grenades, and other things, all the way to ovens, chaise lounges, and arcade machines. In all instances, the interactivity of environments adds a degree of fun to the experience that truly needs to be experienced to be appreciated. Heck, you could even pick up other enemies and swing them around by their ankles, attacking other enemies in the process. If that's not over the top, I don't know what is. All of those bonkers attacks take place in a series of different environments, and here the game does differ a bit from its two-dimensional brethren. In many 2D beat-em-ups, you fight your way through a series of scrolling stages until you eventually find a boss, or you discover an entrance into a new part of the stage. In Dynamite Cop, you have a number of different stages, so to speak, but for the most part, these stages are simply single-screen affairs, where you don't really navigate through a scrollable area. Instead, once you begin moving your character around, the fully navigable environment is visible at all times, which makes the game feel more like a set of 3D fighting game stages as opposed to traditional expansive beat-em-up stages. This works well within the context of the game, and considering the way enemies attack you and the degree of interactivity in each environment, making the stages a bit more constricted makes a ton of sense here. Actually, transitioning from one environment to another requires the elimination of all enemies that might be on the screen, and after you clear all of them out, the game will show a cutscene of you moving from your current scene into the next scene. The cool part here is that on occasion, those transitions will be accompanied by a QuickTime event, where you may have to hit a certain direction on your controller or press the punch, kick, or jump buttons in order to succeed at the QuickTime event. If you succeed, your reward might be the ability to skip a series of fights, or potentially begin the next fight with an advantage over your opponents. Fail one of these events, though, and you might find yourself with additional fights to complete in order to progress in the game, or you might end up getting attacked at the beginning of your next encounter, putting you on the defensive rather than the offensive. From my perspective, these QuickTime events add a degree of variety to the gameplay beyond the traditional beat-em-up mechanics, and I enjoyed each time I encountered one of those events. They are pretty simple to get through, as every single encounter only requires a single button press. It's not like we're talking a series of complex, consecutive inputs like what you might see in QuickTime event-heavy games like Dragon's Lair or Shenmue, but I still appreciated the change of pace that these interludes provided. In all instances, whether the normal fighting stages or the QuickTime events, the action and sequences you encounter playing the game are pretty much all totally over the top in terms of the action and situations you face, and over the course of the game you'll experience pretty much every action movie-styled set piece you would ever want to experience in a singular game. If you appreciate ridiculous over-the-top action, Dynamite Cop has a lot to like here. All of the mechanics we just spoke about form the foundational action that takes place throughout the game, so let's shift gears a bit to talk about how the game is actually structured. In Dynamite Cop, you begin by having the ability to select from three different missions, each of which take place in the same kinds of environments, but do branch out from each other to provide a number of unique encounters. Depending on which mission you select, you may encounter different screens, different groupings of bad guys, and a different sequence of events to reach your final destination, which does add variety and replayability to the game. None of the missions differ all that dramatically from one another, and ultimately you'll have to face the same exact bosses in each playthrough, though potentially in a different order. But I still appreciate having multiple pathways through the game, and as part of my playthrough, I played each of those three missions, along with playing each of the three characters available to you in order to get a full perspective of what the game offers. But because this is a Dreamcast conversion of an arcade game, the goodness doesn't stop there. For those who may be unaware, the Dreamcast was known for its arcade conversions, though rather than simply replicate the arcade experience at home, Dreamcast ports often added a number of additional features and extras to make the home experience even better than what you would have otherwise had at an arcade. And with Dynamite Cop, things are no different, as there are a ton of extras that increase the amount of content you have at your disposal. For one, if you beat all three of the arcade-based missions, you'll unlock three more challenge missions, each of which have additional criteria included to make your playthrough that much harder. These missions, which are known in-game as missions 4 through 6, truly do offer a significantly increased level of difficulty, though other than the challenge criteria embedded in each mission, the actual playthroughs are identical to the analogous missions from missions 1 through 3. I'm glad these extra challenge missions are available, and they do add additional replayability to the overall experience, but they're not what I would consider must-play content. Beyond those additional challenge missions, Dynamite Cop has a series of collectibles that you can grab throughout the game, most prominently illustrations that can be viewed outside of the main game via one of the extra content menu selections. These illustrations are very similar to the kinds of artwork unlocks that you might see in any number of other games, and while I didn't take the time to find and collect each one, it's always nice when games add these extras for interested players. Of particular note, though, is a reward you get if you do in fact retrieve all illustrations throughout the game. If you manage that feat, you unlock the original Bruno character from Die Hard Arcade, which appears to be a simple skin unlock, but is still a fun little extra for dedicated players. Beyond those extras, Dynamite Cop also includes the full version of a classic arcade title from 1980, which Sega had released, called Tranquilizer Gun, which I will admit is an interesting, and somewhat baffling, inclusion in the game, as I don't really think there's any linkage between Tranquilizer Gun and Dynamite Cop, other than the fact that they were both created by Sega. Regardless, in Tranquilizer Gun, you have the ability to shoot a number of different animals with the Tranquilizer Gun, as the game's name would suggest, and your goal is to capture as many tranquilized enemies as possible, dragging their sleeping bodies to your truck, gaining points in the process. If you come into contact with any non-tranquilized animals, you'll lose a life, and because some animals emerge from nearby bushes in a somewhat random pattern, the gameplay isn't quite as simple as the description would suggest. Tranquilizer Gun is one of those addictive, simple arcade titles that permeated arcades everywhere in the early 80s, and I love the fact that it was included with Dynamite Cop. At the same time, I really have no clue why Tranquilizer Gun was included with Dynamite Cop, other than just because, but I do have to give Sega a lot of credit for adding extra content in the home releases of their arcade games, at least those that were ported to the Dreamcast ecosystem. Sega did extras better than almost any other company around this time frame, and it's something that I miss in many releases today. I recognize many games today are more focused on narratives, and as a result, there's not as much of an opportunity to throw a ton of extras into the package that may not really align with the game's core features. But there is something to be said about these over-the-top home arcade ports, and it is a style of release that I wish still existed more pervasively today. Hopefully, it's fairly apparent that the Dynamite Cop package is pretty much brimming with gaming goodness. I'll definitely relay additional thoughts about the game as we move forward, but before we do that, we have to take a look at the back of the box. Because, as you all know, I love looking at the back of the box for these games. I love learning how different companies marketed their titles, especially because, for most of the games we talk about, we didn't have an internet with pervasive, always available information available to us when we were making buying decisions. A lot of times, all we had to make that decision was either magazine reviews that we might have read, or actually standing in the store at the time of release, looking at the box and determining for ourselves whether that would be an appropriate purchase. Now, Dynamite Cop did release a little bit later than a lot of the titles we've talked about, so there was more readily available information, and the internet was at least available, so this is a little bit of a different situation. But regardless, even with that, the quality of the box and the quality of the content on the back of the box still helped to shape our buying decisions, even around the late 90s. So, for Dynamite Cop, for the Sega Dreamcast, the back of the box says, "Got good aim with a rack of beef? Then get creative with your weapons. Hurl anything that's not nailed down at the no-good pirates who've kidnapped the president's daughter. This ain't no clean fight. Jumped out of the arcade to be converted to Dreamcast with special bonuses. Fully interactive environments. Tons of power-ups, moves, and enemies. Many humorous weapons, including vacuum cleaners, pork bones, and hairspray." And then, of course, there are some images on the back of the box as well. And I've got to say, I do appreciate the fact that Sega was kind of just going for that over-the-top thing and really selling it as an over-the-top experience. I don't know that I fully got everything I would have wanted to get out of the back of the box. It was kind of a little bit too ridiculous for me without really focusing on the true game features. I don't know. That's more of a subjective thing. This is a personal preference. I appreciated what they did and how they tried to sell it as this over-the-top action experience. But at the same time, I kind of would have wanted a little bit more content and a little bit less fluff. Once again, that is just me. Regardless, the box itself, or I guess in this case, the jewel case itself, did look good. I did not own this game back when it originally released, but honestly, I kind of want to add it to my collection. Anyway, we're going to move on to start talking about the more specific aspects of the game, and we're going to start by talking about the graphics. The graphics in Dynamite Cop can best be described as late 90s 3D arcade goodness. For those who lived through this era of gaming, you probably know exactly what I'm talking about. But for those who may not have, let me explain. As arcades continued the shift to three-dimensional visuals in the late 90s, pretty much every game took on a very distinct, though consistent, appearance to their visuals. Technology had allowed games to progress beyond flat-shaded 3D polygons to textured, though still visible, polygons to more complex 3D scenes with polygons that were still somewhat visible, but were much more integrated with the individual 3D models than what was available before. Visually, this took the appearance of objects and characters that appeared more lifelike, so to speak, albeit with straight lines and edges still the name of the game, as opposed to the more nuanced, realistic modeling that we have available to us today. These visuals were pretty much common across most of the three-dimensional arcade games of the time, and as a result, were pretty frequently observed within Sega Dreamcast games, since a lot of those experiences were in fact arcade ports. Which is to say, Dynamite Cop looks exactly like what you would expect a late 90s 3D arcade game to look like, which for someone with nostalgia from the time frame is simply awesome. Characters and environments are all nicely detailed with models that feel chunky in a good way. I appreciated the blast from the arcade past that Dynamite Cop brought to my eyeballs, and I thought the game looked really great for the time in which it was created. That being said, there is definitely something lacking here if I look at it from a more modern perspective, or from the perspective of someone who may not have any nostalgia for late 90s arcade titles. It's not that the game looks bad, because it absolutely does not, but the 3D graphics from around this time haven't aged nearly as gracefully as the sprite-based pixel games of the early 90s. While those sprite-driven experiences can often look beautiful even today, with a charm that is sometimes difficult to explain, three-dimensional visuals were often designed to be more realistic, which for the time looked great, but for today is not anywhere close to the modern definition of realism. I still think the game looks really good, but I'd wager some people will look at it and think, "Oh, look at those early 3D visuals." I personally love the way the game looks, but I can see others being less enthused. Beyond the pure visuals, animations are all nicely done and varied, which is great considering the number of different objects and weapons that enemies might bring to the fight. I will say that some of the animations are a little clunky, which is a result of the slightly chunkier 3D graphics that we just talked about, but overall, the action is fluid and the fighting feels hard-hitting, which is exactly what you want in a fighting game. Moving on to the sound and music, the music in the game is pretty darn great, with each and every track meshing well with the action on the screen. My only complaint, though it's not a huge one, is that the musical tracks are all designed to be blasted out of arcade cabinet speakers, which means any expectation of nuance or intricate harmony is pretty much non-existent. That doesn't mean the music is bad, it's just not something I would personally listen to outside of playing the game, and I don't think it has any real memorable themes, other than perhaps the music that plays in between stage transitions, which sounded like a cool 1970s, 80s era cop show soundtrack, which I appreciated. Sound effects, meanwhile, are all top-notch, with crunchy, hard-hitting effects that really do add heft to every swing, hit, and impact. While sound effects aren't something you typically reference outside of playing a game, when they're done right, you take notice, and with Dynamite Cop, the sound effects are definitely done right. One other aspect of the audio environment that warrants mention is the voice acting, because during the various cutscenes that play out as you play the game, you will hear several different voice actors lend their talents to the game. All of the voice work here sounds exactly like what you would expect a late 90s era Japanese-developed arcade title to sound like. It is super obvious that the voices were dubbed from the original Japanese voice tracks, and as is fairly common with dubbed English performances of Japanese content, there is no nuance here, and everything is entirely over the top. Which is to say, the voice acting is absolutely awesome, and is a great addition to the arcade action that you'll be experiencing while playing the game. If this were a different style of game, like something more focused on narrative versus action, I might have more critique against the voice acting, but because this is an arcade action title, it receives both a pass and a commendation for being so over-the-top and arcadey that I can't help but smile every time I hear a line of dialogue uttered by any character in the game. It is cheesy, it's extreme, and it's overacted, which for this type of game is absolutely perfect. Moving on to the narrative and story, you play as one of three different police officers who are tasked with infiltrating a hijacked cruise ship in order to save the onboard hostages, including the president's daughter, and put a stop to Wolf Hongo, the leader of a terrorist organization hell-bent on causing mayhem wherever and whenever he can. Wolf was the main antagonist in Die Hard Arcade, and apparently he did not take his defeat at your hands lightly. He has resurfaced here, seemingly with a vendetta to capture the president's daughter once and for all, presumably for ransom purposes, but also, you know, mayhem. You take your fists and your feet and enter the battle against Wolf's minions, making your way through the hijacked ship, traversing a bunch of different environments, and ultimately facing off against the big bad guy himself. Can you save the president's daughter and put a stop to Wolf's evil deeds? You better be able to. Otherwise, you'll never live up to your reputation as a truly dynamite cop. I've got to say, the story here really worked for me. Sure, the entire plot is effectively a cliche, and you can find similar plot lines in almost every single action movie ever made, as well as a number of action-driven games. But there's a reason why the whole hostages in a hijacked space works so well, and that's because it plays into a fairly common cultural fear that most, if not all, humans share, especially nowadays. Being able to take justice into our own hands by being a trained super cop and defeating everybody that stands in our way is incredibly cathartic, and games like Dynamite Cop allow you to live out that power fantasy. Despite the story being cliched, I honestly have no complaints here. Moving on to the playability and controls, we covered most of the structural elements of the game already, so I'm not going to rehash all of that here. What I do want to spend some time on, though, are the controls, which are simple in concept, but deceptively deep in practice. While playing Dynamite Cop, you really only need to use a few different buttons on your controller. You move around using your analog stick, and you have dedicated punch, kick, and jump buttons, and that's pretty much it. Within those simplistic controls, though, you have a combo and fighting system that allows you to chain together a number of different moves, and like we talked about, each moveset is different depending on the character you select. Overall, the controls are tight, and the game itself is simple enough for anyone to pick up and have some fun with, though there is definitely a mastery curve here that you can pursue if you really want to dive deep into the game's mechanics. And mastery is absolutely essential if you want to tackle any of the optional challenge missions, which are definitely more difficult than the rest of the game. I could certainly see someone playing Dynamite Cop for an extended period of time, because the gameplay loop itself is filled with a constant endorphin drip that makes the moment-to-moment experience of playing the game feel really good and rewarding. I would argue that Dynamite Cop remains perfectly playable even today, with the only element of its package that shows any appreciable age being the game's graphics, like we talked about. Otherwise, the game controls and plays just like you would want any modern beat-em-up game to control and play. My favorite aspect of the game, though, and something I haven't talked about yet, is what happens when you become fully powered up. As you play the game, you'll have the opportunity to pick up power-up items that increase a power meter displayed near your health bar. Assuming you collect 5 power-ups, you'll enter a powered-up state, where you gain access to new, faster, harder-hitting moves and can really decimate your opponents, including some boss fights. Being powered up feels immensely powerful, and if you have even an inkling of a desire to be an ultra-strong, nearly invincible super fighter, Dynamite Cop will scratch that itch really well. The bottom line is the game plays and controls really well, and I can't imagine anyone sitting down to play the game and not having fun. It might be fairly mindless fun, but it is fun nonetheless. So overall, how did it feel to play Dynamite Cop? Well, honestly, it just feels very satisfying to play, and your ability to take down endless hordes of enemies with a variety of moves and grapples never gets old. My very first experience playing the game involved me grappling someone before DDTing their head into the ground, followed by several roundhouse kicks that moved into a suplex before I picked up a nearby chair and pummeled another bad guy into oblivion, after which I jumped halfway across the screen, landing a flying back kick. As I surveyed the scene with broken pieces of the environment all around me, along with a number of broken enemies in my wake, I felt like a true action hero. The gameplay can become a bit repetitive over time, though, so while I believe the game has a ton of replayability, I don't know that I'd recommend playing the game for hours at a time. This is the kind of game where you drop in for a few rounds whenever you're looking for a power trip, and after those few rounds, you can shut the game down, content that your over-the-top martial arts craving has now been sated. So what is our verdict on Dynamite Cop? Well, obviously, it is a fun, engaging, and somewhat deep, actually, beat-em-up experience that I truly believe needs to be experienced by everyone at some point in their gaming careers. It is over-the-top, ridiculous, and plain enjoyable to play, and the Dreamcast version of the title adds in enough extras to keep you coming back for more. At the same time, though, I do believe it can become a bit stale over time, as even though there are three normal missions and three challenge missions, they all take place within the same environments and level structures. While the environments all look good, I would have wanted a bit more variety to keep things fresher for longer periods of time. If Mission 1 was on a cruise ship, and Missions 2 and 3 were in different locales, I think this would have addressed that particular critique, and likely would have made this one of the better beat-em-ups ever created. But because each mission is effectively only a minor variation of each other, you basically end up with a single mission at the end of the day, and that mission isn't particularly long, clocking in at around 25 to 30 minutes worth of gameplay. Because of that, I believe Dynamite Cop is a strong addition to our list of golden oldies. It is definitely a great game, and I highly encourage everyone to check it out, but I don't think it's going to have quite as much staying power as it could have potentially had if its missions were a bit more varied. To reiterate, this is based on my experience playing the game as a solo player, so it's entirely possible that the multiplayer experience would feel even better. But I can't speak about that since I didn't personally experience it myself, which is why for me, Dynamite Cop has just become the newest member on our list of golden oldies. That was our episode on Dynamite Cop. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT. I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. I highly encourage you all to check it out. I also highly encourage you to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including a Patreon-exclusive bi-weekly podcast expansion pack, patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday is where it's at. Before we sign off for the week, I do want to mention that our next episode is going to be another Patreon-sponsored episode, this one coming from Rich Shadowald. We're going to be looking at Starship Titanic. So if anybody has any particularly fond or not-so-fond memories of that experience, definitely let me know. At the same time, I recognize you're likely listening to this podcast on any number of podcast services, and if you would feel so inclined, it would be great if you could leave me a review. This is not about bolstering star counts. This is not about trying to harvest a ton of 5-star ratings, but if that happens, awesome, it means we're doing something right. No, what it's really all about is trying to deliver the best possible podcast I can. The only way to do that is to get feedback from all of you to make sure that I am hitting the mark and delivering the content that you all want to listen to. We get new listeners every single day, which is absolutely amazing. I want to continue to deliver the content you all want, and I want to continue to try to create the best possible podcast I can. We'll be back in around a week with our next episode focused on Starship Titanic. Until then, remember, sometimes the games of the past are just as good, if not better, than the games of today. Goodbye, everyone.